Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group and the George Mason University School of Law's Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. It was recorded on Friday, April 19, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform Conference Call on What's Next for Copyright Enforcement, Rogue Sites and Other Challenges, co-sponsored by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, as well as the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University School of Law, which is dedicated to the scholarly analysis of intellectual property rights and the technological, commercial, and creative innovation they facilitate. My name is Christian Corgan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Bruce Boyden, Professor Mark Schultz, Mr. Steve Tepp, and our moderator, Professor Adam Mossoff, to our call. More complete bios for our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. I'll now turn things over to our moderator, Professor Adam Mossoff. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. It's a real pleasure for me to be moderating this panel today on the topic of what's next for copyright enforcement, rogue sites, and other challenges. This panel will be addressing the issues that arise from the ongoing challenges presented to copyright owners by the online and digital environments, in which copyright owners continue to experience the unfortunate instance of large and wide-scale copyright infringement. How should we be responding to these ongoing problems? Should there be legal responses? Should there be responses via social norms? What should be done with response to technological changes, to rogue sites in foreign jurisdictions? And what other type of innovative solutions are copyright owners currently exploring or attempting to implement to address the problem of wide-scale and ongoing infringement? Our speakers today are Professor Bruce Boyden, Assistant Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School, Steve Tepp, President and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide, and last but not least, Professor Mark Schultz, Co-Director of Academic Programs and Senior Scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property, and Associate Professor of Law and Director of Faculty Development at Southern Illinois University. Each of these speakers will speak in the following order that I just listed their names, starting with Professor Boyden. They will each speak for approximately 8 to 10 minutes, which then will leave us at about 12:30, and we will open up the floor to questions and answers from the audience. So we will first begin with Professor Boyden, who teaches and writes in the areas of copyright, internet law, privacy, legal history, and civil procedure. He's published widely in these areas in many law journals, most recently in the George Mason Law Review and in the Alabama Law Review. He is a graduate of Yale Law School, where he served as a note editor of the Yale Law Journal and as an editor of the Yale Journal of Law and Feminism. He has an MA in history from Northwestern University and a BA summa cum laude from the University of Arkansas in history and philosophy. His current research focuses on the interaction between copyright and changing technology, an ideal topic for this teleforum. So without much further ado, Professor Boyden.
Thanks, Adam. Before we talk about where to go from here, I want to talk for a few minutes generally about how we got where we are and what that means about the future challenges for copyright law. The fundamental difficulty that I see for copyright now arises from the fact that we're in the midst of a profound transformation in how information products are created and distributed, a shift from media in physical form and physical locations to digital distribution. Now, everyone obviously is aware of that shift, and it's upended copyright law in a number of ways because copyright has long depended on underlying assumptions about the costs and physical nature of copying and distributing goods. That may sound a little counterintuitive because copyright is a right to intangible property, namely the copyrighted work. When copyright began in 1710, that was the point, to give copyright owners the right to extract payment at a remote distance, to be compensated for every attempt to publish or publicly perform their work by anyone, anywhere. The work could be more broadly disseminated that way, reaching a wider audience, and yet its creator would still be able to reap the benefit. But copyright has always depended on the fact that in the physical world, there are a limited number of control points where works can be obtained or seen: bookstores, theaters, broadcasting towers. That is, there's a limited number of gates to content as a practical matter. And that means that there's a limited number of gatekeepers in the physical world. Copyright applies to the persons who control those gates. It's always been written in universal terms as a universal obligation that applies to everyone, but for almost three centuries, it was really just a regulation of publishers and professionals and repeat players in the creative or knowledge industries. That's the fundamental thing that has changed. With the advent of network computers, now everyone is a publisher. Everyone essentially controls a gate. And so copyright applies as a de facto matter to everyone. But that's proven to be unworkable. It's one thing to require industry professionals and repeat players to understand the nuances of copyright law, idea expression dichotomy, substantial similarity, fair use, licensing. But it's another thing entirely to require the general public to follow a detailed statutory and common law scheme. What you tend to get from the public as a result are a few simple rules and casual practices based on their experience. And enforcement efforts against individuals have, as is typical in most areas, barely been able to put a dent in these essentially default norms that have been adopted, and there just really aren't enough resources to do much more. That leads for me to two conclusions about where to go next. First, if copyright is to survive as a means of enforcing payment for works at a distance, there have to be new gates. The old gates are becoming too leaky. One of the few areas where a relatively small number of big players control access to content for the foreseeable future is ISPs, both access providers and websites such as user-generated content sites. The major difficulty will be in ensuring that any legal obligation that's placed on such ISPs corresponds well enough with their actual abilities to target infringing content and only infringing content. To go back to my gate metaphor, it will depend on just how much control the ISP in question has over the gate. Too little control, and either ISPs will be threatened with large liability for behavior that's effectively beyond their control, or they'll over-deter non-infringing uses, which undermines the perceived legitimacy of the regulation. The key will be, as it was with restaurants and bars in the early 20th century, who initially didn't like being subject to the public performance right, whether a relatively simple way to enforce, to come up with an enforcement mechanism like the ASCAP and BMI site licenses can be found. I want to talk about three possibilities. First, for egregious behavior, there is inducement liability currently being enforced by the courts for intentionally encouraging infringement, such as what we saw in the Columbia Pictures versus Fun case recently decided by the Ninth Circuit. Second, the law might require ISPs to deploy filters that can be easily and effectively implemented by ISPs. That's admittedly a hard thing for legislation to specify in advance, what needs to be in those filters, how they should be designed, what they should weed out. But one requirement might be that if a filter is already being used by the ISP for some content, that it be applied equally across all content. One of the more disappointing aspects of the Second Circuit's decision in Viacom versus YouTube, I thought, was that it held that a failure to do that, to equally filter across all content, didn't lose the ISP its immunity under Section 512 of the Copyright Act. That is, YouTube, in that case, offered automatic scanning of its content to identify potentially infringing content for content owners that had entered into a special deal with it, but not for all copyright owners. And Viacom and others in the case thought that the obligation should be more general, but the Second Circuit, basically in a footnote, disagreed. Finally, the copyright alert system, or the so-called six strikes policy, although at this point it's voluntary, might wind up being such a promising solution. But since it involves direct application to users, I think its success will ultimately depend on how well it is accepted as legitimate by the public. And that leads to my second and final conclusion. Because copyright now applies as a de facto matter to just about everyone, the politics of copyright have become Byzantine. Gone are the days when only a relatively few stakeholders could agree on legislation and it would get passed. The one thing clear from the battle over SOPA and Protect IP, and I know those are controversial subjects, is that there is a substantial chunk of the public now that can get agitated about copyright issues. That means that the public relations behind any proposed legislative or regulatory solution will be a critical component of whether it will be a success, not merely whether it's signed off on by the usual industry groups. For example, is there a simple story or a relatively easy to understand or explain story that explains what the provision does? And does the text of the legislation match up with that story? Long, very complicated, insanely complicated provisions will make public defense of them difficult. So will broad provisions that go beyond the specific justifications offered. So any viable legislative solution, I think, will need to be as narrowly tailored as possible in order to accomplish the foreseen goal. I think what we'll see in the future, assuming that there is legislative activity at all in the copyright realm, is that the text of the bill itself will become an important part of the lobbying effort, and that's a significant challenge as well going forward.
Thank you, Bruce. That was fascinating. Our next speaker on our panel is Steve Tepp, who is, as I said, is President and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide, which was recently launched in January of 2013. He is also Chief Intellectual Property Counsel for the Global Intellectual Property Center at the U.S. Chamber of Council, or U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Steve served as a Senior Counsel for the Policy and International Affairs at the U.S. Copyright Office, where he was involved in substantial matters involving both copyright regulations as well as legal developments. He co-authored the Copyright Office's Digital Millennium Copyright Act Section 104 report to Congress in 2011, as well as its 2003 and 2006 Section 1201 rulemakings. He has been involved in copyright-related matters that have been taken up before the U.S. Congress since the mid-1990s. He's a graduate of American University's Washington College of Law and has an undergraduate degree from Colgate University. Steve?
Thanks, Adam. Thanks very much. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm happy to have this opportunity. I need to make one little correction. I am no longer Chief IP Counsel for the Chamber of Commerce, though happily I'm still working with the Chamber in my new capacity at Sentinel Worldwide. And in that vein, I should add that my remarks this afternoon are entirely my own and not necessarily the views of the Chamber of Commerce or any other client. It seems to me that this being the Federalist Society, I would be remiss if I began anywhere except the Federalist Papers. And as many of the people on the call may be aware, Federalist 43, written by James Madison, addresses the constitutional grant of authority to Congress to protect copyright as well as patents. And what I'd like to note here, and I think this actually relates back to some to a piece of what Bruce was just saying. Bruce gave us a very nice historical overview and then jumped into some of the particulars of how copyright is applied and enforced in the modern day context. In between there, I think it's useful to go back to the fundamental philosophy of copyright in the United States, embodied in the Constitution. And that is, of course, that we promote the progress of science by securing for a limited time to authors the exclusive right to their respective writings. Science, of course, back in the 18th century, being the term for what we now consider creative works. the philosophy there is fundamentally a free market capitalist approach. If you give people the property rights in what they create, you will get more and better creations, and you will have them distributed more widely. And thus it was in Federalist 43 that Madison wrote, the public good fully coincides with the claim of individuals. That is, even though we contemplate giving individuals rights in their creations, the public benefits from that because those creations will be more numerous and distributed more widely. In the modern context, unquestionably, as was described in the introduction, we have unprecedented levels of infringement of copyright, to the point that it threatens to undermine this fundamental incentive for the creation and distribution of new works. That's no more so pronounced than in the internet context, where the nature of the technology is such that it is available for abuse by criminals on a massive scale, indeed unprecedented. We all want the internet to thrive, but with upwards of a quarter of all internet traffic involving intellectual property violations, we need to do better. There are some who would have one believe that rule of law and property rights are incompatible with a vibrant internet. I reject that. I think that's a false choice. The reality is creative content and innovative distribution are mutually dependent businesses, and both suffer when criminals are allowed to dominate the field. So the question becomes, what can we do to address this criminal behavior, often offshore in source, in a way that still preserves the fundamental goals of both copyright and the benefits that we all enjoy of the internet? I think that necessarily has to be a multi-pronged solution. One aspect of it that I find very encouraging is a proliferation of voluntary arrangements among responsible businesses here in the United States. There are arrangements right now between intellectual property owners, including copyright owners, and certain payment processors to try and cut off services to these criminal online sites that are infringing and stealing our most creative and breakthrough products. Similarly, there are arrangements with advertisers. It's all too common, unfortunately, that well-known and respected companies find that their ads have been placed on websites that are engaged in overwhelmingly criminal activity. That's not something they've chosen to do, of course, in an affirmative way. Usually they've simply placed an order for the placement of their ad, and these sites, being unfortunately very popular, attract ads as a place where many eyeballs will see the ad. Without exception, once these responsible companies are informed of this, they correct it. And so work has been done and an arrangement has been put into place to help that flow of information so that advertisers and advertising networks can be made aware of the bad sites, the criminal sites, and to avoid placing ads there. We've also seen an announcement from Google that they will lower the ranking in search results of sites that have been the subject of a large volume of notices of alleged infringement under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's also an encouraging sign. I think some people are still waiting to see the practical results there, but it's certainly an encouraging sign. And we've already heard mention of the Copyright Alert System, which is, for those of you not familiar with it, a voluntary arrangement between a number of internet service providers and entertainment companies to provide educational notices to customers of the ISP that are alleged to be involved in infringing activity. And there was a reference made to six strikes. I think the term strike is probably inadequate because a strike suggests there's some point at which you're out. That's not the case in the copyright alert system. There are notices that come as a result of information being provided by the copyright owner to the internet service provider, who then provides information to the subscriber. And they are informational in nature. After, I think it's the fourth or fifth notice, the ISP at its discretion could require, for example, a customer take an online copyright information course, for example, or perhaps even slow down the connection for that customer. But that's the maximum that's required under that system. But to be sure, as I said, it's got to be a multi-prong approach. And because many of the criminal operators and infringers are located outside the United States, there's got to be an effort to go to the source, to seek the assistance of governments in, of countries in which these sites are operating. And we've seen some successes there. And there are a number of continuing, ongoing efforts in that regard. The free trade agreements that the United States negotiates and has been negotiating for about a dozen years now include intellectual property chapters that require our trading partners to raise their level of intellectual property protection and enforcement to modern global standards. And there's a new trade agreement currently being negotiated right now between the United States and I think we're up to about a dozen partners throughout the Asia-Pacific region. That's known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that holds a lot of promise given some extensive amounts of IP violations coming from that region to improve the situation dramatically. We've also seen progress in what historically has been a very difficult place for intellectual property to thrive, and that's in China. They have recently issued a decree from their Supreme Court, and they're considering right now updates to their Copyright Act, which I think provide at least some cause for hope for improved situations there. And there have been some stepped up enforcement as well. Don't get me wrong, there are still tremendous challenges in China, but we are seeing some movement in the right direction. And finally, in addition to voluntary measures and education and foreign government cooperation, there's also a role for classic good old-fashioned enforcement. And we've seen some actions by the U.S. government in this area against some of the most notorious thieves that, again, I think are very encouraging. And while the problem remains a large one, I think there's a lot of movement in the right direction. I don't think it's necessarily going to require a lot of legislative action. As you can see, I've gone through a number of examples, none of which are legislative. So I'm hopeful that we can make progress on this in this sort of consensus way that that not only moves us forward and informs consumers, but ultimately I think has an effect on consumer expectations and public opinion. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. Our final speaker on our panel is Professor Mark Schultz, Associate Professor of Law and Director of Faculty Development at Southern Illinois University, as well as a Senior Scholar and Co-Director of Academic Programs at the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property. Professor Schultz has written and spoken frequently around the world about the importance of legal institutions that support the creative and innovative industries. For instance, he's been a distinguished visiting scholar at the University of Botswana, where he's given lectures on property rights in traditional and indigenous knowledge. He currently serves as chair of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group. chair of the ALS section on internet and computer law, and has served as an NGO delegate to the World Intellectual Property Organization. He received his JD with honors from George Washington University and a BA in International Economics from George Washington University. Mark?
Thank you, Adam. By the way, I'm past chair of some of those committees you listed. Thanks. Today I'm going to be talking about social norms. And the reason I'm motivated to talk about this topic is because I've heard at over the years many people say that the public's infringement of copyright has gone too far. They're too used to it. And social norms are such that we're never going to persuade people to obey the law again with respect to copyright. I've heard professors say it, students say it. I've even heard recently that, Capitol Hill staffers all grew up, young Capitol Hill staffers all grew up infringing, and we're never going to convince people on Capitol Hill again because of that copyright enforcement is important. And the example people most often use is prohibition. They say, look, prohibition didn't work. People kept drinking. People kept breaking the law. When your whole society disagrees with a law, you're not going to change people's minds. You have to give in. And I'm here to say that that's lazy thinking. It represents a failure to analyze the situation thoughtfully. And it represents a misunderstanding of how social norms and the law interacts. So I'm going to talk about, I'm going to talk first in the abstract somewhat. I'm going to talk about four potential reactions to a social norms problem like this. And then I'm going to use a specific example, a recent example regarding the campaign against ad-supported piracy as an example of a way we can change social norms and make some progress in this area. Okay, four potential reactions to a social norms problem. First, one potential reaction is surrender. A second potential reaction is deterrence. You ramp up enforcement, you push harder when people continue to break the law. A third potential strategy is adaptation. You find other ways to persuade people to obey the law, or you find ways to change what you're doing so that the law breaking is not a problem. Or fourth, persuasion. You persuade people to change their behavior. All right, let's look at each of those issues, those strategies in turn. When should a society surrender to social norms when social norms are no longer in compliance with the law? Is surrender the only strategy in that kind of a situation where you have massive disregard for the law? No, it never is. There's two things that policymakers look at in a situation like this. One is a cost-benefit analysis. We've had instances where societies people engage in large spread disregard of the law, drunk driving, speeding, and recently in the United States, crime in large cities in the 70s and 80s. And the analysis one does when one is faced with this kind of large, widespread disregard for the law is you ask whether the cost of enforcement, whether the cost of continuing to try to persuade people to obey a law is worth it, or whether the harms that come from continuing to clash with society's norms outweigh the potential benefits of enforcing the law. And clearly, in the case of things like drunk driving and crime in large cities, we've made a decision to continue to try to enforce the law and have had some success in changing people's behavior. A second factor one has to look at is morality. We have experienced in our society episodes of massive disregard for the law. For example, massive resistance to the implementation of civil rights for African Americans. And we made a moral decision as a society to continue to push to enforce those laws, despite how contentious it was. Other societies have similar problems where morality dictates that one continues to try to enforce the law despite social norms. For example, in South Africa recently, surveys and research showed that over a third of men in a couple particular provinces in South Africa admitted to having raped women. In other words, rape was such a widespread problem that it had become a social norms problem. The government of South Africa identified it as such, and they said, of course, as any civilized society would, that we cannot stand for this. We cannot surrender to this. We will continue to press. Now, I don't suggest that file sharing is a problem on the level of civil rights or widespread rape, but the fact that one pauses and considers that there are differences among social norms problems tells you that there's something else besides a lack of compliance with the law that dictates what we do. And that thing is morality. We ask whether a law is worth enforcing in and of itself, not just whether people are willing to comply with it. Okay, and I will say that I don't think it's time to surrender yet with respect to copyright. We've just begun. Other strategies, as I said then, if you're not going to surrender, include deterrence. When one is trying to deter improper behavior, the important thing to recognize is that enforcement sends a signal in and of itself. Enforcement is important for deterring people from misbehaving, but it's also important for telling the rest of society that a particular offense is looked down upon and shouldn't be engaged in. And so enforcement is important for the normative signal it sends. And we also have to recognize we'll never get 100% compliance. We'll never get 100% enforcement. And we don't need it. If we persuade enough people that it's wrong to do something, we don't have to devote our resources to watching people at all times, because people will police themselves. So our enforcement strategy by necessity needs a normative component. Another further reaction to a norms problem is adaptation. A society can do two things. When it's faced with a norms problem and it wishes to adapt. One is it can try other means of enforcement, indirect means. As we did in our big cities, when faced with crime waves in New York and other large cities, they began to crack down on petty crimes. They began to try to send signals to people that bad behavior would not be tolerated in order to make it just more difficult for thugs to roam the streets armed. To lock people up who are engaging in petty behavior so they couldn't do worse criminal behavior. That kind of indirect enforcement strategy is something that the copyright industries have attempted with suits against Grokster, Napster, and other intermediaries, and that kind of indirect enforcement strategy continues today with working with ISPs to crack down on file sharing. This kind of indirect adaptive strategy makes it harder to break the law. The other obvious form of adaptation is new business models. And new business models are important, an important reaction to the social norms disconnect, but the key issue is that these business models need some breathing room. These business models won't work, and they won't be worth trying unless there's at least some enforcement and some willingness among consumers to try the product. Finally, there's persuasion. And persuasion seems soft and fuzzy. It's difficult for lawyers to get their hands around. But persuasion can be very effective because most people obey the law most of the time, not because they're afraid of getting arrested, but because they believe it's either wrong to misbehave, or that they don't want the social condemnation that comes from misbehaving. And so persuasive campaigns are actually often most important to persuading people to obey the law. And I think these persuasive adaptive and deterrent strategies all need to work together. And let me give you an example. I'm going to go to my example now of the campaign against ad-sponsored piracy. USC, the University of Southern California, their Annenberg Innovation Lab has started an online advertising transparency report. What the online advertising transparency report does is they report monthly on the top 10 advertising networks on illicit file sharing sites. So they go to CyberLockers, for example, and sites that list links to torrents, and they see who's advertising on there. They see what ad networks are showing up on it, and they list the brands that are showing up on those sites. And what we find is some of the world's most respected brands are showing up on those sites. Last month's report noted the top advertisers included top advertisers and brands included Adidas, IKEA, Windows 8, Amazon, the American Heart Association, Marriott, Lexus, and the U.S. Forest Service. Now, just by calling out these brands and these ad networks, the Annenberg report has already done a lot of good because these brands don't want to show up on these cyber lockers. What this campaign is doing is sending a message, and the campaign is being engaged in, of course, through the research of the Annenberg Innovation Lab with the cooperation of musicians like David Lowry of Cracker through his blog Tricordist, East Bay Ray of the Dead Kennedys, are coordinating artists in sending the message to brands that ad-sponsored piracy should not be tolerated, that these cyber lockers are sleazy, they're illegal. Not only do they contain copyrighted material, but like any black market, they contain all sorts of other kinds of illicit material, including child pornography. And these brands, these respected brands, don't want their advertisements showing up on sites offering that kind of material. And this campaign's already been effective. Many brands have started trying to ensure that their ads don't show up on these websites, and certain advertising networks have blocked the pirate sites, including the Internet's most important ad network is Google. And make no mistake, these websites exist to make money. This isn't some romantic, idealistic, information wants to be free activist movement. These websites are sleazy black markets that exist to make money. If we starve them of their ad revenue, they will die off. And so the campaign against ad-sponsored piracy is a good example of both a persuasive and adaptive strategy. It's persuasive because we're changing people's views of these websites and what it means to be associated with them. And it is also adaptive because by cutting off the funding, we indirectly deter the behavior. And this, I think, is a very promising strategy. And in the end, why it is not time, it's an example of why it's not time to surrender.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. Sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Just finish it.
All right. We're running a little long, so I just want to make sure we have enough time for question and answer. Sorry for cutting you off, Mark. We will now go to the floor for the question and answer period. So I'm going to turn it back to Christian to review the procedures. Christian?
Yeah. Thanks, Adam. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key.
And while we're waiting for... And while we're waiting for people from the floor to start their asking their questions, I'll take moderator's privilege to ask the first question. What I found fascinating about all of these presentations, I apologize for my misstatements about various people's biographies, once again proving that you cannot trust everything that you find on the internet when you are searching for information, is the heterogeneous and dynamic approach that people have all reflected in the various presentations. Bruce's talked about the different gates, how the old gates are leaky, how you need new responses and new solutions to this, It involved various solutions he reviewed, covering both legal public ordering responses, private ordering responses like filtering, and other types of private ordering responses like the copyright alert system. Steve as well covered a variety of approaches, again covering both private ordering responses through voluntary agreements and education, public ordering, and public ordering responses involving foreign agreements, treaties, and ultimately enforcement. And lastly, Mark's comments, with his emphasis on social norms, emphasized a lot, I think, the importance of kind of private ordering responses, adaptive responses to problems. With the given background of public ordering enforcement and what you can do in response to that. I find it interesting that all the speakers kind of centered around these various, this kind of more broader framework. And do you think that, do you all agree that this is kind of the approach that one has to take to this type of system, or that one has to be careful not to be reductionist in one's thinking about copyright and in modern technological world?
Go ahead. I was going to say yes. I think one thing to acknowledge is that this is a big problem. It's a big problem brought on by a change in technology that, as Bruce said, for the first time makes copyright a consumer problem, not a problem of rival commercial pirates. And so when you have such a big problem, it's not a marginal problem. It's a fundamental problem, and you have to pursue it from many different avenues. It's different from, say, a regulatory issue where a particular targeted type of firm, you want to change that firm's behavior. You can probably make some small marginal incremental change in the law to, say, make it more expensive to pollute, for example. A firm will rationally then change its behavior because it's well-informed and likely to respond to that change. But this is a big problem. It needs to be dealt with on a big scale with multiple avenues. Yeah.
Adam, this is Steve. I was going to agree that it certainly requires a multifaceted approach. And one of the points I wanted to emphasize here is that while this particular technology that we're looking at now is certainly new, the notion that copyright law evolves around technological and market developments is anything but new. In fact, it is the defining history of copyright law. Arguably, the very first Copyright Act in Britain, the Statute of Anne, was a response to the invention of and distribution of the printing press. And as you look at the history of copyright since then, the invention of photographs, motion pictures, recorded sound, computers and the software that makes them run have all been technological innovations that have provided new areas for creative expression. By the same token, technologies like the player piano and the photocopier and the audio cassette and the VHS, and as well as the modern technology we're talking about today, have all presented various challenges to copyright protection through the years. We've always been able to adapt the copyright law to find a way to continue to provide that fundamental incentive for the creation and distribution of works and still allow those works to be consumed by the public that wants them. And that, of course, is the goal.
If I could just pile onto that. So, I would agree that the way I see it, there's basically like three moments of transition across copyright's history. The copyright itself sort of spun out late out of the printing press and the printed books. And then there's the emergence of mass media in the early 20th century, leading to the 1909 Act. And now we've got networked personal computers. And so everything's in flux all at the same time. All of the features that you legal entitlements and their scope, enforcement practices, business practices, public practices, and you can't just look at one strand of that in isolation. What's the perfect legislative silver bullet here that would be the ideal statute to address this problem? You can't isolate a factor like that.
Thank you. Christian, is there anyone in the queue yet?
We do not have any questions. Our line is open, so if you have a question, please press star and then the pound key. While we're waiting to hopefully get a first question, I do want to do one quick programming note and let you know that our next Teleforum call will be Monday, April 22nd at 2 p.m. for a call on what is left of the Alien Tort Statute after the Supreme Court's recent decision in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum with Julian Koo and Shemin Kietner. Adam, do you want to field any additional questions to the panel?
I was wondering, while we're waiting, I was wondering perhaps maybe do any of the panelists have any questions for each other?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Well, I might have one for Mark at least. Obviously, you know, a lot of what you said is you know, in line or consistent with what I was talking about. The one thing I'm wondering about, though, you know, if in distinguishing things like prohibition and the campaign against drunk driving is, you know, the harms from that sort of behavior are huge. And so the costs in both in enforcement costs and also in just the cost of sort of resisting public inclinations that would that you could undertake that wouldn't be outweighed, where the benefits would outweigh them, are correspondingly large. But where the costs are lower, you know, infringement by an individual of a copyrighted work, you know, depriving at some proportion of sales. You know, the costs are going to have to be the costs that you undertake in enforcement or response are going to have to be correspondingly pretty low. And so, you know, how does that leave enough room available, you know, to undertake attempts to change norms, or are we talking about a sort of a, you know, very limited space to play in?
Well, I guess. The first question is the premise, right? And there's
sure. What's in the premise?
Yeah, and so what's the cost of abandoning our copyright system, essentially of ceding the field to widespread infringement? There's a financial cost, and sure, there's a big debate about what the actual cost of piracy is, and there's no need to get into that now, but I'd say it exists, it's real. There may be a debate about how many billions of dollars it costs creators, but there's a cost. Beyond that, though, you know, I think with any of these normative questions, one ought to look to the social and moral cost. What is the importance of supporting culture in our economy? What's the importance that we have people who can make an independent living from creativity, that we have entire industries that commercialize those creative and informational works? I think there's our copyright system plays an essential role in democracy, as both scholars and the Supreme Court have acknowledged, that we have lots of independent sources of information and debate, and it's created a tremendously thriving and vibrant culture that has really been the envy of the world. You know, I'm not one of those copyright professors who doesn't own a TV. I'm one of those copyright professors who likes TV movies, and I think we've got a lot to offer in our present culture. And anything that undermines that, we ought to really pause to question it on both an economic basis and a moral basis. So I think there is, you know, there's lots of room for debate as to how much room we have to work within. I think it is worth incurring a cost. The other thing I'd say is we've just begun to fight. This problem has gone on, 13, 14 years? That's not a long time. I know lots of people, lots of bloggers on the internet like to sneer at the content industries, how long it's taken them to adapt, oh, they're such dinosaurs. But the content industries have worked hard to adapt. Professor Mossoff, our moderator, just released a paper on publishing, scholarly publishing industry, where he finds that the publishing industry has spent billions of dollars on new technology trying to deliver scholarly publishing better to its customers. And we find that with the creative industries. They keep trying. And we've got lots of great new things we're benefiting from. I love Netflix. Streaming, Spotify, Amazon, I can watch anything on demand. So I think we're just beginning the fight, and we're adapting, and we need more time, and it's worth it. I think it's worth it, and we do have some margin within which to work. Well, that's my response.
Thank you. Christian, do we have any questions from the audience yet?
We do not.
Okay, well, let me throw it back to the let me throw a question to perhaps start with Bruce, and if anyone else wants to start in, I appreciate that. You had mentioned the politics of copyright is now Byzantine, that the public can become substantially agitated with the introduction of legislation, that there needs to be better PR in terms of communicating why solutions are necessary. But it also seems from both Mark's presentations and from Steve's presentations, in fact, Steve said so explicitly, that legislation may not even be necessary, right? That we can adapt and respond to, or at least the content industry can adapt and respond to copyright infringement through existing legal mechanisms, through perhaps new treaties, through enforcement, through other private order mechanisms, and through even social norms. Do you, given that you referenced the politics and legislation, do you think there is a role here for ongoing legislative efforts, or is this something that should be left more to the courts to evolve through common law fashion or through private ordering mechanisms, either through other types of legal mechanisms, contract or property or even social norms?
Yeah, I think eventually there'll have to be legislation of some sort to adapt. I mean, the 76 Act is getting older and older. The Register of Copyright proposed that it's time to start thinking about a new copyright statute. It took 20 years after, similar thoughts were expressed in the 50s to get the Copyright Act of 1976. Which really was to, handle all the changes in media that occurred since 1909. I think new legislation will be necessary at some point. I don't foresee a world in which voluntary sort of agreements will and even changes in norms will be able to handle everything. And there might be a difference between me and Steve on that. I'm not sure. But the problem I see is I see the world in which there's a few big players, even in the ISPs or among the ISPs or any entity really, a few big players, commercial entities controlling a large amount of content creation or distribution is fading as a 20th century mass media phenomenon that will progressively decline, and so we'll be left with more players of smaller significance. And getting them all to agree in a voluntary sort of way will be more and more difficult. So that's the future I foresee, and that's why I'm assuming that there's going to need to be legislative changes at some point.
Steve, Bruce kind of mentioned you, I thought maybe I'd give you an opportunity to weigh in as well.
Sure, happy to. I think we fundamentally agree that at some point, yes, there will likely need to be legislative updates to the Copyright Act. As I said, it's always reacted to changes over the years. I think that voluntary measures and the types of things I was describing earlier are almost certainly swifter than legislation. As Bruce said, the 76 Act took about 20 years to from conception until birth. So that's not exactly swift, but at some point, sure, they'll need to be either tweaks or possibly at some point down the road, a broader revision. In the meantime, I think given the scope of the problem, and I think Mark did a great job of describing exactly how harmful abandoning the field would be, there are lots of things that we can do that are not legislation.
So I'll chime in here and say I think we're likely to need some revision to copyright, perhaps in part because the 76 Copyright Act in particular departed from a property rights paradigm in many ways. A property rights paradigm is quite useful when you define broad property rights and then allow private ordering to adapt. We've done a lot of public ordering in the Copyright Act, and it enshrines a lot of arrangements that have in mind particular situations with respect to cable and broadcast and satellite and other players. So as technology changes, if you've been that specific in your lawmaking, you're going to have to adapt. But I don't think we need reform in the sense that we should step away from the property rights system that still lies at the core of copyright. That's the wonderful thing about property rights. They're adaptive, and the movie industry looks different from the music industry, and it looks different from the publishing industry. And a lot of those differences aren't just in the product; they're in how those industries have chosen to order themselves through their respective guilds, standard contracts, and business practices. And there's others who've chosen not to enforce their copyrights or to enforce them selectively. And they can continue to do that as well. Property rights allow for wonderful diversity, so we need to stick to that system at its core. And I'd argue, being the coming from the perspective I do, we need to, if we're going to revise copyright law, we should move back toward that important core rather than further away from it.
Thank you, Mark.
Adam, this is Christian. We do have one question on the line, so if we've got time.
Certainly. I think we have a minute or two. We can probably close out the teleform with this one question.
Fantastic.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. I apologize for coming in late on the call and also for my cold, but I have a slight disagreement with my friend Professor Schultz. I think that in addition to looking at the moral component of copyright law, we need to look at the constitutional component, and in particular, whether the law as currently being followed is genuinely promoting the progress of science and the useful arts, particularly given the way copyright term continues to get extended. We may have reached the wrong balance, particularly in such, I would suggest, not particularly helpful or moral areas as online pornography or publishers suing patent lawyers for keeping copies in their file of the articles that they sent to the patent office as prior art. And I just wonder if any of the panelists would like to respond if that was not covered in the first 20 minutes of the program.
I'm happy to, but Mark, since you were mentioned, do you want to go first?
No, you go ahead, Steve.
Okay. I think it's important to distinguish between some of the subtleties of the Copyright Act, whether it's the precise length of the term or various terms of statutory licenses or the scope of certain exceptions and so on which reasonable people can disagree, and that's what the legislative process is about if and when we get there. And in the meantime, that's what negotiations are for, and if it comes to it, even litigation. But that is of a whole different class than I think what we're really focused on this particular call, which is fundamentally the theft of copyrighted works, regardless of what the term is, the types of uses that no one would argue are fair or reasonable, that undermine the incentive to create, that steal from creators. And how do we address that? What's the best way to address that? And I think we've all outlined that it needs to be a number of different approaches. I've emphasized some of the voluntary approaches, some of the international approaches. When we come back to, if and when we get to a place where those types of crimes are brought a little bit more under control, then I think it's a different area of discussion to talk about, for the law-abiding user, what are the reasonable rules of the road? And so that's a fair question, and I don't know that I agree with you about the copyright term, but that's a discussion I'm happy to have on a different day.
Well said. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Mark again. One thing, when I when I teach my students, I like to emphasize that a lot of what's important about copyright doesn't show up in the appellate case reports and thus doesn't show up in a case book. The economic importance of copyright is for most creators and creative industries and copyright owners is the fact that it protects the commercial value of their work, and it protects against people simply, you know, infringing on a commercial scale, wholesale copying of their work and appropriation of it without paying for it. Typically issues that we spend a lot of time as academics debating and studying in case books like fair use and even to a large extent copyright term, I know that has a commercial aspect as well, but those things are about the creative appropriation or follow on creation. And that is an important economic and moral aspect of copyright, but the main and the plain of copyright is ensuring that those who create works and those who commercialize works can get a return on their investment, can get a reward for their productive labor, and are enabled to live a full and flourishing life based on, you know, the benefits of what they've created and appropriating the economic value of it. And that part of copyright hasn't changed. I don't think it's out of balance. In fact, what's out of balance is the ability of creators and commercial entities to recoup a return on their productive labors. And that's what I'm concerned about, particularly in this call.
Thank you, Mark. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our teleform today. Christian, is there anything that you need to say in closing out?
Sure. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of our experts today for joining us on the call. Thank you to our audience for joining us as well. We welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And please do join us Monday, April 22nd at 2 p.m. for a call on what is left of the Alien Tort Statute after the Supreme Court's recent decision in Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.